Welcome to this podcast by the Heinrich Böll Foundation. This is the third episode in the series called 50 Years of ASEAN, Still Waiting for Social and Ecological Justice. This is your host, Johanna Son. One shared feature of daily life in many cities in the Association of Southeast Asian Nations is, as you guessed right, traffic jams and air pollution. These daily stresses highlight the need for better mobility in the urban jungles of Southeast Asia, which are linked to economic vitality, productivity, growth, and national and regional development. But they also raise the question of how to balance this need with sustainable transport, which considers the impact that improved mobility and transport can have on the greenhouse gas emissions of a country or a region. Sustainable transport actually goes way beyond personal mobility in cities and reaches all the way to how freight moves across an increasingly integrated ASEAN community. But this episode looks first as an everyday issue. How societies in the region are coping with the challenge of moving people about in a way that does not undercut their own future. Tanyarat Dokson is not quite your typical commuter in Bangkok, the bustling megacity of 9 million people that is the Thai capital. For a decade now, the journalist has been taking a 20-minute bicycle ride to a workplace each day.
It can be quite scary, you know, if you think of it, because motorists in Bangkok are not like the most considerate drivers or riders in the world. But you know, after you get out there in a while and you feel confident enough, you know, and you make yourself visible to other motorists, you know, and other commuters, I think it's safe enough to go around and bike. I mean, you just have to like shake that fear first.
Tanyarat is the administrator of the Bike to Work group in Bangkok, whose Facebook page has 10,000 members. Apart from giving her more control over her time, she says biking has the added bonus of not adding to the world's environmental woes.
For me personally, that's how I think. You know, I think that the world is not going to get any cooler. You know, it's getting hotter and hotter. So if you can do one bit to help the world by not adding, you know, gas consumption or, you know, any kind of, you know, fossil fuel consumption, that'll be the best.
It is quite a jump from an individual's everyday behavior around transport to greenhouse gas emissions, which in this case are usually carbon dioxide and black carbon. But having more and different choices of getting around in the region caught in the motorization culture, cars and motorcycles, creates avenues that lead to more sustainable transport in Southeast Asia. Transport and mobility and the stresses associated with these are an everyday challenge for individuals as well as a development question. Bjørn Pedersen, a Danish national who is executive director of Clean Air Asia, a non-government organization based in Metro Manila in the Philippines, shares with us his insights.
I think if you look across the region, it is in most of the countries increasingly becoming a challenge. And one of the major reasons for that is, as you rightly mentioned, urbanization is taking place across Asia at a very, very rapid speed. With up to, some predict, in 15 years' time, you'll have more than 55-60% of the population living in cities.
It isn't only urbanization that is underway in the region. Though more than 60% of ASEAN's population living in cities easily means more than 230 million people. But this is happening together with other factors: rapid motorization, high urban density, fast growth of megacities or cities with more than 10 million people, and some studies say the decreasing share of public transport in many ASEAN cities, even if mass transport schemes are increasing overall. While transport has been identified as a key contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, the demand for transport in ASEAN is also projected to increase by 60% from 2013 to 2040, according to data cited in an article on low-carbon transport policy published in the Sustainability Open Access Journal of the Swiss-based MDPI, or Multidisciplinary Digital Publishing Institute. Transport accounts for about a quarter of Southeast Asia's final energy consumption.
Cities is growing fast, and not necessarily always with the proper attention to urban development and especially low emissions urban development, which would facilitate mobility. Rather actually the opposite, where you see the increased number of people going to cities resulting in congestion, urban sprawl, etc., with all Hamburg's transport, which has a profound effect on people's lives, whether it is in terms of efficiency or the ability to a society to function in a rational way without spending too much time, either from the personal point of view in traffic or carrying or freighting goods and services, or it is air pollution. When you see more urbanization, it often results in more cars.
The ratio of passenger vehicles per 1,000 residents is at a high 300 or more for Indonesia, Thailand, and Vietnam. Thailand and Indonesia also lead in terms of the domestic production of cars and motorcycles, the same Sustainability Journal article adds. It is not only commuters who are stuck in traffic, but Southeast Asia's governments as well, argues Red Constantino, who heads the Manila-based Institute for Climate and Sustainable Cities.
It is vital that the region's economies approach transport with a strategic sense, in a way anticipating the impact that economic development is likely going to bring to the region. And unfortunately, with the exception of some initiatives in the region, Southeast Asia still lags far behind in terms of transport and mobility strategies and the region's economic projections in the next two decades. There's a stated intention. Transport and mobility are part of the vision. Some have begun to integrate transport and mobility into economic strategies, but as far as reality is concerned today, there's a big gap that still needs to be closed. More often, this is because of the fixation with the wrong thing. For instance, in the Philippines, the fixation is on traffic, which is stupid and short-sighted because the challenge is really about moving people, not vehicles.
The car culture, in short, is quite prevalent in the region where roads are often seen as being for motorized transport instead of for people. Individualized motorized transport is seen as a sign of progress. Is this culture particular to Southeast Asia? Is it a stage that everyone passes through? If one looks at Europe, for instance?
That's a very good question. I think that it is a stage that you go through, but I think also it is a car or the access to freedom to transport yourself around is intrinsically linked to development in a lot of cultures. So from the US, where the car is a symbol of the freedom to ride, to Europe, where it's very much a symbol of having a family, to Asia, where it's part of the development, you have cars, you have mobility. I think it is part of our development to have the freedom to transport ourselves around. I think the key is then how does countries and city handle that desire for freedom? That is what differs.
So people might be free to get a car, but this only leads to more problems without what Red calls systems thinking about sustainable transport.
Traffic is a symptom, and probably a symptom that can never be fixed and should never be the focal point of governments across Southeast Asia, only because if there are mass transport options that are available, traffic as a problem should be a problem of people who own cars, not people who actually have mass transport options. And it's fundamentally about democracy and the ability of the working middle class and the working class of any country in the region to be able to lead productive lives without getting hampered by their lack of private motorized vehicles.
Cities badly need to provide more practical options to their residents beyond mass transport and other systems, both Bjorn and Red point out. This can involve a menu of options, better technology that becomes affordable and therefore usable, better urban planning and road feeder linkages using taxes as incentives or to discourage vehicle ownership, better control of emissions from vehicles, better and safer mass transport options from buses to elevated rail systems, among others. Despite its problems, mass transport systems, often in the form of elevated rail lines, are found in more cities today, even if it has taken decades for some to become reality. Singapore is known for its stiff charges on vehicle ownership and fees for using roads in the city center during peak hours. The Philippines is poised to institute a vehicle ownership tax. The Philippines and Indonesia continue with their practices to limit vehicle use on certain days. Some consumers, like the journalist Tanya Rat, chose the option of buying hybrid cars like the Toyota Prius when she cannot use her bicycle.
I was forced by my parents, my Asian parents, to buy a car, and I chose to buy a hybrid car, in order to save the energy and to help the world. And I think that's the trend that a lot of people are thinking as well.
In short, while Southeast Asia cities face challenges in moving toward low carbon transport, they are not starting from zero. Of ASEAN's four most populous countries, Indonesia has the highest carbon dioxide emissions from transport at 121.4 metric tons a year, followed by 61 metric tons from Thailand, 28 from Vietnam, and 23 to 36 from the Philippines, according to the study published in the Sustainability Journal. The article says that the four countries constitute four of the five largest transport sector emitters of greenhouse gases in the region. At the same time, ASEAN countries' climate change commitments do include goals to reduce carbon emissions from the transport sector. Regionally, there is an ASEAN Transport Strategic Plan 2016 to 2025 covering land, air, and maritime transport. It aims to form a policy framework, quote, to support sustainable transport, which includes low-carbon modes of transport, energy efficiency and user-friendly transport initiatives, integration of transport and land use planning, close quote. Societies that work to improve mobility often use methods that discourage some behavior and options and encourage others, Bjorn explains.
Clementine, in European countries, the combination of carrot and stick in Norway has meant that it has one of the highest uptake of hybrid and electrical cars in the world, simply because if you have such a car, you do not pay for parking, you don't pay road toll, you get free parking, you are exempt for road tax, you're exempt for vehicle tax, etc. That, I think, is becoming quite appealing for a lot of people.
But then, air pollution is something people can see, smell, or breathe. How does one make the matter of lower emissions from one's transport choices a matter of personal interest?
The reason why people are often not that concerned on an individual level on climate change, or indeed link their mobility choices to climate change, is because climate change is, for many people, removed in time. That the consequent of your mobility choice today might be a negative one in terms of climate change, but in reality it's not going to impact me before in 10 to 20 years. And that is not the time horizon that most people think of in terms of actions. They often think in a shorter time frame. I think it's been well proven that the behavioral change of climate change, so not the government change, but the individual change, the sort of the voluntary element of it, have not really taken off. The reductions in energy consumption you've seen is very much associated with technology innovations, so energy-saving air condition, more efficient cars, buildings, production, rather than coming from individuals who have changed their behavior.
But the awareness that cleaner air is good for reducing carbon emissions helps make the climate change aspect of transport much more direct to many more people.
I do think that when we marry the air pollution agenda with the climate change agenda, because it's the flip side of the coin, or win-win situation, as many say. Often reduction in CO2 emissions is good for climate change, or good for mitigation of climate change. It's also good for reduction of air pollution, which is then in turn good for your health. And that narrative, I think, is becoming more and more convincing.
ASEAN countries are in a unique setting. Their urban communities remain home to many traditional ways, but are also very comfortable with high technology. In many ways, they mix first and third world settings, one might say. So while their cities have many of the old headaches, they have also been exposed to new approaches and more affordable new technology, including lessons from other parts of the world. Southeast Asia might have to leapfrog in some sense in the next 20 years to more sustainable solutions, because its urban woes are right here today, Bjarne explains.
Despite the need for development, the mistakes that has happened in the rest of the world in terms of individual car ownership cannot happen in the foreseeable future in Asia. That can be mitigated by the car revolution of driverless car, electric cars, etc. But we can't see the fossil fuel-based way of transporting yourself around. It's not an option in Asia if we're going to avoid climate change. That is the reality. So Asia, in many ways, will have to be much more innovative than the more traditional development path we've seen in other parts of the world.
Once a conducive environment for mobility is in place, consumers will do the right, logical thing simply because it works for them.
I don't think people wake up in the morning and go out and say, I intend now to pollute the world by getting into a polluting car. In reality, if people have the choices of walking or taking public transport in a safe manner, then more often than not, they'll do so.